Hello and welcome to COVIDcast, a Lowy Institute podcast for anyone interested in understanding the effect of coronavirus on the world and international life. I'm Sam Roggeveen, Director of the International Security Program at the Lowy Institute in Sydney, Australia. As this crisis unfolds, we're sitting down with experts from a range of fields to discuss the implications of coronavirus for the world. In this episode, I'm speaking with Professor Hugh White, Emeritus Professor of Strategic Studies at the Australian National University. Hugh has served as an intelligence analyst, journalist, a senior advisor on the staffs of Defence Minister Kim Beazley and Prime Minister Bob Hawke, and as a senior official in the Department of Defence. Hugh was the first director of the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. He was the principal author of Australia's 2000 Defence White Paper, and his most recent publication is How to Defend Australia. Hugh White, welcome.
Good to be with you, Sam.
Let me begin by asking you about the balance of power in Asia, an issue that's preoccupied you for, I'd say, two decades. What are the implications of the pandemic for the power contest between the United States and China?
Well, I think the first thing to note is that that power contest and the shift in the distribution of wealth and power that underlies it is a big, long-term, decades-long trend. And we often find it hard as humans to keep an eye on those big long-term trends. We're much more attuned to responding to short, sharp shocks. Now, we're seeing here a classic example of a pandemic as a short, sharp shock having its principal long-term consequences in the way in which it affects those long-term trends. And I do think the key story here is that the pandemic has both amplified and accelerated the escalating strategic rivalry between the United States and China, which in some sense has been brewing since it became clear that China really was growing, and which has become much more intense in the last few years, and I think, again, much more intense in the last few months. So I do think when historians look back at this moment, one of the key consequences of the pandemic will be seen to be the way in which it has just steepened the curve of escalating rivalry between the US and China, and also, I think, as I say, amplified it, that it increased the range of possible things that could happen. I think for that reason, it is a very worrying time.
And yet, the theme that you have been running for a long time now in your analysis about the power shift in Asia is that that shift is all about China's rise, not about America's decline. So in a sense, it shouldn't matter if what you're saying is right, that really this is a story about an incredibly populous country also becoming rich and not about the existing great power, the United States, becoming poorer or any less capable. If this story truly is all about China, then why should it make any difference at all that the United States is having a bad coronavirus?
Well, good question. Two points. The first is, the rise of China is all about China. You're quite right, as I've been analysing these issues, writing about these issues over the last couple of decades, often Americans in particular have said, you know, you don't have to worry, America's not declining, to which I say, I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in China rising. And so I think to that point, you're absolutely right. But the story about the rivalry between America and China that results from China's rise, that is a very relative thing, and it depends a lot on what's happening with the United States as well as what's happening with China. Now, I don't think that the trend that I mentioned, the way in which the coronavirus is amplifying and accelerating the rivalry, I don't think that's solely the result of the fact that America has had a bad pandemic. But I think that the fact that America has handled the pandemic so badly, and conversely, the Chinese so far seems to have handled the pandemic relatively well, that has just, if I can put it this way, amplified and accelerated the amplification and the acceleration. So I don't think the fact that the difference between the quality of their pandemic experiences is really core to what we're seeing.
Myself, I would argue that when you combine the coronavirus crisis in the United States with the recent riots that we've seen and disquiet that we've seen in America's streets, it shows that America's problems are overwhelmingly domestic and not foreign, and that in that kind of environment, it would be very difficult for any political leader, I mean, Trump's not going to do it anyway, but perhaps Biden in the future, very difficult for them to make a strong case that the United States ought to be engaged in this huge, you know, multi-generational contest for power in Asia when so much is left to be done on the home front. And so in that sense, my argument would be that coronavirus, in a sense, saps the will and the resolve of the United States to stage this contest. But on the other hand, I could argue against myself and say, look, America's always been preoccupied with domestic affairs, hasn't it? I mean, 1968, for instance, was a massive year of protests and riots in the United States in the midst of the Vietnam War.
Certainly, this is a very hard time for America. The pandemic and the way it's been handled, the racial violence, the underlying long-term economic problems that the US has. But precisely as you say, the comparison with 1968, for example, when America was deeply embedded in the Cold War around the world and had these terrible problems at home all the way through Watergate and all of that. But the difference between then and now, seems to me, is that back then the United States, notwithstanding all the domestic problems, found the resolve and the resources, the sheer money, and the willingness to accept risks to confront the Soviet Union around the world and to accept very, what seemed at the time, and we should still see looking back, as very serious risks of a major war with the Soviet Union, because it felt impelled to do so, because containing the Soviet Union was so essential to America's well-being, indeed, as people believed at the time, probably rightly, but who can be sure, that they believed that it was essential to America's survival. To me, the big contrast between those times and now is not that the United States has got lots of domestic problems, it's that the imperatives for the United States to contain China are not as strong as the imperatives to contain the Soviet Union was, because China poses a different kind of threat. And it does seem to me that it's very hard to argue that America must bear the burdens and pay the price of containing China in East Asia the way it felt it had to do that with the Soviet Union. But the other effect of the pandemic is a little bit contrary to that, and that is it's not just that you have this, you know, massive distraction, to put it mildly. It's also that it's changed the dynamics of American politics and has amplified the trend for both sides of US politics to beat the anti-China drum and indeed to compete in that. So I think it's made one of the things that's made the situation today more serious, more dangerous, is that the two sides of American politics are competing to see who can be more anti-China. And particularly, I think with Trump's floundering campaign, and it's early days, but I don't think it's too early to call his campaign at the moment floundering, the danger that Trump will start doing really irrational things in order to improve his electoral prospects in November grows, and the chances of China being the target of that are high, and therefore the chances of crisis instability between now and the first Tuesday of November seem to me to be pretty serious. I think we might look back at last weekend's Oklahoma rally and its evident failure for the Trump campaign. It's a very scary moment because it's the moment when Trump gets really reckless.
But the trend in your commentary over the years has been that initially you identified an oncoming contest between the United States and China for power in Asia. In more recent years, though, you've essentially said that you've revised that view and said essentially the United States will in the end decide not to compete for power with China. If there's a trend in American domestic politics towards blaming China, then that suggests maybe a turn back towards the first point of view that there is going to be a contest.
Well, I think that there's a contest. The question is, how's it going to be resolved? And there are, in theory, three possibilities. One is that China backs off. I think that's so unlikely we can forget about it. Another is that the rivalry keeps on escalating and the risk of a war increases if both sides keep pushing. The third is that the US backs off, and the fourth is that they do a deal. Now, I've always thought the deal was the best outcome, never thought it was the most likely. My book, The China Choice, was all about encouraging people to think about that option. I think the chances of that happening are now very low. So we're really down to two options. That is, America pulls back or it pushes on. And I think the choice is essentially America's. I think there are elements of the present situation that push in both directions. In the long term, I think it's very hard to see the United States having sufficient imperatives to contain China in East Asia that it will bear the burdens and pay the price of what you said would be a decades-long generational contest, and an immensely expensive one. We don't want to forget when the United States confronted the Soviet Union, it was spending 8% of GDP on defense in the 50s, 6.5% of GDP in the 70s, back up to 6% in the 80s. That's double what it's spending at the moment. So, you know, this would be a hugely costly and expensive thing. So I think the long-term trend is that the United States will back off, will leave Asia. Very radical view, but I think that's where the facts point. But in the short term, I think the chances of American political leadership, American intellectual leadership, working themselves up into a frenzy about the need to compete with China in Asia, the talk of a new Cold War, suggests that the people within the Beltway, the people who actually make the decision, are perfectly happy to see this confrontation escalate and may not have the judgment to avoid a crisis which would lead them into a war, potentially a truly catastrophic war, over an issue which in the long run is not worth their while. One of the things that really worries me is that I don't think even many of the very sophisticated Americans, people we know, who are at the heart of these debates in the United States, seem to have no idea how serious a confrontation they're talking themselves into. They just don't understand how dangerous and powerful China is. Just as for years, they didn't understand that China was going to be a strategic rival at all. I spent most of the 2000s and well into the 2010s trying to persuade Americans that China was even a serious rival. They only woke up to that in about 2017.
I just want to take a slightly different tack here, Hugh, and ask you about your premises. You're, I think, thought of maybe slightly reductively as a foreign policy realist. Your emphasis has always been in your work on power balances expressed largely through economic and military power. I wonder whether the virus, and in particular the way that governments and the public have reacted to it, cause you to rethink at all the nature of power and think maybe about media power and particularly social media to move world events. And I just want to quote something briefly to you. An essay I read recently by a tech writer in the US named Mike Solana, who I hadn't heard of before, but he wrote a wonderful essay which he simply called Jump. And it starts with a story he learned as a child, a kind of a fairy tale, I suppose, that if every person in China jumped in the air all at one moment, then the earth would be thrown off its axis. And of course, never mind the physics of it, but purely the idea of organizing that many people to jump in the air all at one time was impossible, except perhaps until today. And so I just want to read a brief section of what he writes. Today, almost half the global population is connected to the internet by supercomputing smartphones that live in our pocket. That's 3.5 billion people. More significantly, the way we access news has paradigmatically changed. We no longer learn about the world from institutions. We learn about the world from people we care about. This binds our sense of truth to tribal identity, and that is a powerful, fundamentally emotional connection. It's also now operating at the scale of a planet. Today, a single piece of information, a tweet from your president, an update from the World Health Organization, video footage of police brutality, is polarized and shared across our social network. From there, it can reach hundreds of millions of people, often furious, in less than an hour. That's a lot to take in, and I apologize for the long quote, but I just go back to the question, which is I wonder whether you've had any cause to rethink the nature of power as a result of the virus and the public response to it.
Well, I'm going to give you a risky answer to that one, and that is the answer is no. Because it does seem to me that notwithstanding all the things that are floated in that very interesting quote, and I remember the story about every person in China jumps at once when I was a little boy, it does seem to me that overwhelmingly these things are still or can still be mediated by states. The heart of my analysis and the reason why my analysis has often in the last couple of decades sounded different from a lot of other people is that I still put states right at the heart of the story. Because they continue to have unique power. No human institution, no human arrangement is as powerful as a powerful nation state. And they remain, they have an astonishing grasp on people's emotions and their motivations, and they marshal astonishing power. And that can be power for good, but it can also be power for evil. Nothing is as destructive as a state on the rampage. And, you know, what one of the key differences between me and most other participants in these debates is that I've always seen the risk of war between America and China, and the risk of that being a nuclear war, as being a really significant factor in everything we think about, the way in which their relationship evolves. And that's because I do see them behaving very much the way states have always behaved. I keep on finding that the methodologies of 17th century, 18th century, and 19th century power politics continue to work pretty well in the 21st century, notwithstanding the fact that the technologies have changed.
So there is a lively debate. I mean, there has been for a long time, really, about the significance of shocks to the course of international history, and whether disasters, no matter how costly in human lives or in economic wealth, whether they really change the fate of nations and the balance of power between nations. And some would argue that it's really only war and big major wars that change the balance of power. I'm guessing you would put yourself more in that category.
Well, yes, except that I don't think it's just war. The thing I really look at, you touched on this before, is the way in which the distribution of power, overwhelmingly the distribution of wealth, shifts. I mean, I think, you know, it's always hard to get our head around the idea that we're living through history too. History is not just something that happened to our grandparents. And that the shift in the distribution of wealth and power of the last 30 years, as China in particular, but India too and some others, have risen, That overturns the redistribution of wealth and power that occurred with the Industrial Revolution in the late 18th and early 19th century. This is as fundamental as anything going. And we are working through that. You know, for 250 years, to be wealthy and strong meant essentially to be white and to be North Atlantic. And when Americans, as I believe they very often do, continue radically to underestimate what a serious rival China is, it's partly because I think they just can't get their head around the fact that the global distribution of power today is radically different from it was. And the shift has been incredibly quick. It's occurred within my career. Now, you know, my career is 40 years old now, but still 40 years is not very long in the grand sweep of history. So it's that. It is, in a sense, it's a short, sharp shock. It's only 40 years since, you know, Xi Jinping transformed China's economic outlook. But I think it's that which is really important, that and, of course, and wars. But one of the reasons why wars are such a big deal is that they do so much to change the distribution of wealth and power. Some states survive and other states go under.
They change the balance of wealth and power, but they also determine who gets to write the rules for the coming peace, right?
Yes, but I think that they determine that by determining who's got the power to enforce it.
Yep.
I mean, the Second World War, for example, and you could say the same about wars in the 18th century, which left, you know, the Napoleonic Wars left Russia and Britain in a uniquely powerful position. The end of the Second World War left America and the Soviet Union in an unusually powerful position. It destroyed the power of Japan in Asia. It destroyed the power of Germany in Europe. It's taken a very long time for that to be redressed. Still hasn't, in fact. But it was the way in which the outcome of the Second World War changed the distribution of wealth and power in across the globe, really, both ends of Eurasia, that made the post-war period so distinctively bipolar.
So, Hugh, I did want to ask you about something that you've written about over the course of the pandemic, which is the episode regarding the international inquiry that Australia was seemingly so heavily involved in prompting. Why do you think Australia was wrong to insist to Beijing that the origins of the virus be examined objectively?
Oh, I don't think it was wrong to, well, insist is a dangerous verb to use. I don't think it was wrong for Australia to propose that such a thing should be done. I think Australians are perhaps being a little bit self-centered if they imagine that we were the only people who came up with that idea. It was a statement of the obvious. Where they were wrong was to, where Morrison was wrong, was to frame his proposal in terms which were so obviously going to be interpreted in Beijing as implying Beijing's guilt. Beijing carried responsibility for things that it had done or things that it should have done but didn't do. Now, it's perfectly reasonable to presume that that might well be one of the outcomes of the inquiry. It was a very big mistake to propose the inquiry in terms which presupposed that was the case, and particularly to do it in ways which so vividly foreshadowed an affront to Chinese sovereignty. Morrison drew an analogy between the kinds of powers that the inquiry should have and the powers that weapons inspectors should have. Now, he himself makes a great play of the significance of Australia's sovereignty. To use language like that to China seemed to me to be needlessly, willfully, inexplicably provocative. And he could easily have been counterproductive. I'm a little bit surprised that the Chinese ended up accepting an inquiry at all. And the inquiry they accepted was one was on terms they were prepared to accept. They would never have accepted an inquiry on the terms that Morrison proposed it. So it seemed to me to be needlessly provocative. And it's one of a number of things the Morrison government has done in the last little while, which seemed to me to have needlessly provoked China. It's not that I think there should be any taboo on provoking China, but you shouldn't do it unless you're going to get a benefit. And I don't see what the benefit is from doing this.
Hugh, just in the little time we have left, two quick last questions for you. I'm always interested in how people think as well as what they think. So I just wondered what you've changed your mind about since the pandemic began. It came to our notice, I guess, first in January, February, and then it's really changed our lives in March. There may have been things you thought about the world then as it started really impacting that has been where you've revised your view on the evidence.
Yeah, look, interesting question. You know, the first point to make is that although I'm a million miles from being any kind of epidemiological expert, but I became quite interested in how pandemics work as a security problem back at the time of SARS. And so I was a bit conscious of pandemics. And I've been struck since by how little attention I paid to the rising sort of pattern of stories out of Wuhan in January and February. Now, there's partly an explanation for that. Like everyone else in Australia, I was a bit preoccupied with bushfires. But as an example of, you know, I've spent a lot of my career trying to persuade people how they should respond to crises. As an example of not recognising a crisis when it's on its way, that was a pretty good one. So the first thing is, I've changed my mind about how serious this is, and it took me surprisingly long time for me to wake up to it. Hmm. The second point is I'm surprised by how I have been surprised by how readily governments around the world were prepared to crash their economies in order to respond to what, even at the time they were taking these extreme measures, were still kind of pretty theoretical scientific prospects. You know, the fact that everyone started talking about curves and flattening the curve, and people started talking about exponential growth. People who'd never used the phrase exponential growth in their life were suddenly starting to talk about it. Interesting example of how science really can grab hold of the policy agenda and drive governments to make really major decisions. I'm not saying they're incorrect, but that was an interesting example. And the third thing, I guess, that surprised me in a way has been the way in which how hard the Europeans were hit, how well the Chinese appeared to handle it. I tend to, just in a sense, being contrarian, I tend to presume that the Chinese are doing better than many other commentators in this field do. But I've been a bit surprised that the Chinese response seems to have been so effective. And of course, like so many other people, notwithstanding my deep doubts about the effectiveness of the American system of government, I've been surprised at how badly America's done. And I do think, going back to something we touched on earlier, I do think that's quite significant.
Yeah, me too. In fact, at the beginning, I was of the view that, you know, the Americans generally, historically, are pretty slow to react to big crises. But once they muck in, they really muck in.
Yeah.
And they get things working, but it just doesn't seem to have occurred in this case.
Yeah.
Final thing, Hugh, what's the best thing you've read about the pandemic? What can you recommend to our listeners?
Well, in some ways, I don't feel I've yet read anything that goes very much beyond the sort of points we've been touching on. That is that the big effect of this is to amplify pre-existing trends. In fact, the most interesting thing I've read has been, and I particularly have been focusing on the Financial Times, it's been the day-to-day coverage of the actual trend of the pandemic. I've been very interested to watch how the media has provided often very high quality statistical information about the trends. And that's actually been my revelation and if you like, my literary solace through the last few months.
Hugh White, thanks again for joining me for today's discussion.
Good to be with you, Sam.
COVIDcast is a limited edition podcast from the Lowy Institute. Thank you to my colleague, Jennifer Reinhardt, for production assistance. Please keep an eye on our social media channels for details of the next episode of COVIDcast, and you can stay up to date with all the latest developments on coronavirus via the Lowy Institute's digital magazine, The Interpreter.